You're listening to Ask the CIO, brought to you by CenturyLink. Now, here is your host, Jason Miller.
My special guest today is Susan Swart, the outgoing State Department Chief Information Officer. Susan, thank you so much for taking the time to do, if you will, an exit interview with us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So you decided to take a new job. I think that was the big news about a month ago, I guess now. Tell us about that job at the IMF.
Well, it's the CIO position at the International Monetary Fund. I'm anticipating starting there on August 20th, and I'm looking forward to taking on a new opportunity and new challenges.
So the CIO at the IMF, now this is going to be, a bit different than the State Department. The State Department, you've been a foreign service officer for many years. So are you just leaving government service, or is this a kind of a retirement plan?
Well, I am retiring from the Foreign Service after 23 years and moving on to the IMF. I was attracted to the job at the IMF because they have an important mission. They have worldwide impact. They have a diverse workforce, and they're international.
And does that international piece attract you? I mean, being a foreign service officer for most of your career, you've spent probably a chunk of it at least overseas.
I think the fact that the mission has impact overseas, you know, beyond one country, yes, that was something that attracted me.
And why now? 23 years seems like a long time, but in a sense, it's not. What made you decide now? Was it just the opportunity that presented itself from the IMF, or was it something else? Is it just was time to take a new challenge?
I think a combination of both. I mean, 23 years is a good foreign service career. It was a combination of, you know, I'd been back in the States for, 7 years. I've been back from since my last overseas assignment. I'd been in the CIO job for 4.5 years, which is a long run, as you know, for a federal CIO. And when this opportunity came up at the IMF, it seemed like a very good transition.
Talk a little bit about your career a little bit. 23 years, as I said, it's a nice, healthy length of time. You've been posted where? You've had what kind of experiences over that time period?
I've been posted twice to Cairo, once very early on in my career. In fact, it was my first overseas assignment, to Caracas, Venezuela, Lima, Peru, and then back to, later on in my career, back to Cairo. I've also been in a number of jobs domestically.
And when you look back across that, you know, the State Department CIO job is the most recent one, the one you're leaving out. 4.5 years is a long time for a CIO. You must have seen a lot of change, a lot of your colleagues come and go in the CIO position. Did you feel like 4.5 years was a long time as a CIO? Give me a little bit of a sense of just kind of your career in the CIO role.
Actually, being in the job day to day, I didn't feel like 4 years was a long time. But as I watched the people on the Federal CIO Council change and start noticing that, well, Casey Coleman is sometimes the only face I recognize from when I started, I think, wow, yeah, I've been in the job a long time.
CIO jobs are lots of pressure. They're enjoyable. You get your hands in many different pots. Give me a sense about why that role fit you so well. And as you move to the IMF, you're going to take on probably a very similar role, though I know that there's a lot to learn about the IMF.
I think how my career, my experiences within the Foreign Service, having served overseas and domestic in a variety of positions and a variety of bureaus with different kind of components of, let's say, the State Department mission, I think that gave me a good sense of what various parts of the department need IT to do for them. And after all, IT is something that's there not because it's a State Department mission to provide IT, but because IT facilitates other aspects of the foreign policy mission. So I think my experience, both domestic and overseas, suited me for that position.
And your background, again, is it technical mainly? Did you kind of become a strategy person that kind of learned technology?
I started out as a technical person. I mean, my basic experience or my first job in IT was in programming, and probably really during college in the tape area, you know, mounting tapes for old IBM mainframes.
I was going to say, you're not that old, probably not COBOL.
Yes, I did COBOL programming.
You could always have a job with the Social Security Administration. So even in post-retirement, you could be in good shape then.
Yeah, and I think if my code was tight, I was a good programmer. So I started out with a technical background, and some of our IT jobs overseas in the State Department, they are, and particularly going back, you know, 20 years, they're hands-on. And that's truer the smaller that the embassy is. So I did start out with a very technical background, but then as you move up and you manage, you know, you lose some of those technical skills. I mean, you lose a lot of those technical skills and move into the management, the oversight, the planning, the strategy.
And you get to hire people with good technical skills.
Right, exactly. And modern, up-to-date technical skills.
The Java and the C++.
Yeah.
Which part of the job, when you look back, did you like the best? When you're a coder in overseas, or when you got the chance to actually tell the coders what to do and get the end result? Or, you know, you each had their benefits.
Yeah, I think each have their benefits. You know, if you're a coder and you can solve a problem with that code and you can do it in a way that you think was very economical, and meets the customer's perspective, that's rewarding. But I think as you talk, as you look into management or providing IT services on a broader scale, the same kind of things are rewarding. To be successful in providing those services that your customers want, or to doing it more cost effectively or more efficiently, or bringing in a new technology effectively into the organization, those are rewarding too.
No matter what you do with the IMF, you'll probably bring in both of those knowledge bases, the operation side and the strategy side, just because that seems to be natural when you talk to CIOs, even new CIOs who go to an organization. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to delve deeper into your time as state CIO. You're listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My special guest today is Susan Swart, the State Department's outgoing Chief Information Officer.
This audio puzzle is brought to you by CenturyLink Government.
Let's see, growing digital needs go here. So many different applications over here. So where does IT budget stretch to the limit go?
Fortunately, CenturyLink Government has an answer with its vast portfolio of cloud services, so customers get the right mix of performance and features. CenturyLink, solutions that work, service you can count on.
For a free risk assessment, visit CenturyLink.com/federal. This audio puzzle is brought to you by CenturyLink Government.
Okay, synchronize email and instant messaging over here. Merge web and video conferencing down here. But that leaves mobile, landline, and VoIP phones out of the loop.
Solve your agency's communications challenges with CenturyLink Government Unified Communications, products that work together and help deploying and maintaining them. CenturyLink, solutions that work, service you can count on.
For a free risk assessment, visit CenturyLink.com/federal.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My special guest today is Susan Swart, the State Department's Chief Information Officer. Now, Susan, before a break, we're talking a little about your career, 23 years as a Foreign Service Officer, deciding to move on to the IMF as its new CIO. But when you look back at your time at State Department, specifically as the CIO, what are some of the projects, programs that you really can say, you know, I'm really proud I was a part of that?
I'm just going to talk about those things that happened over the last, you know, 4 to 6 years, not going, you know, way back to serving overseas or anything. The consolidation of utility IT, you know, some the consolidation of the desktop, of our network functions. We had many different bureaus and offices domestically that were providing similar duplicative services. And I think we've done a good job over the last 5 years or so consolidating that into a single service.
Now, that's a difficult thing. Let's touch upon that for a second. Now, you guys also just put out a series of RFPs that go back to this as well. How do those relate?
Those were an attempt to consolidate the many different contracting vehicles and task orders that we have to do operational, what I'll call operational support services. And that was to get better coordination among all of those contractors, basically, in providing overall support to IT operations in the department.
But then that's different
than the idea of consolidation, right?
Because you're just consolidating the contracts for the support versus
right.
The actual servers.
The services, yeah.
Okay. How difficult was that to combine to get the other posts and stations of the State Department to kind of agree to consolidate? Because everyone wants to hug their server, we know that.
Right, everybody wants to hug their server, and they want to do that because they're concerned about the service that they provide to their customer. And I think that's the biggest hurdle. It's not really the technology. The technology is not that complex. It's getting people to be confident that you are going to provide the service that they require to do their job. And we still have issues there, but we have, I think, good mechanisms in place to hear from our customer. We have forums where our customers come and talk about that. We survey for service. We monitor the costs. So we have a lot of things in place that I think help to improve that trust relationship.
What kind of impact has that had? Can you look at a monetary impact, a service impact?
Monetary, yes, on those things that we have put into our working capital fund and we charge back to the customer. We can see over time the costs have reduced. The charges that we're charging out to our customers have gone down. On some of the other, I think it would be a little bit harder to show some of the cost savings. I think there have been cost savings, but in many of the areas, data centers, things like that, they've continued to grow. So there's not just a constant baseline that you're taking from many different, let's say, different data centers or different organizations consolidating, and they're staying stable. They're all growing. The demand for those kind of services is growing. So that's a little bit harder to measure. But I do think we've had cost savings in those areas, too, and that they're more efficient. We have redundancies we didn't have before back, you know, multiple data centers.
From the cost savings standpoint, are you able to use that cost savings and put the money back into other IT programs or into mission? Or is it still maybe too early because it takes time to kind of get the savings?
I'd say a combination of both. Some of that has stayed within IT, but some of that has gone back to mission because the people that are paying us for the service, they're no longer paying. You know, the payments have dropped, so then they can use that. Or the department writ large can use it back into the mission.
So instead of paying $20 an hour, now they pay $17 an hour, so that $3 an hour can go somewhere else.
Yeah.
I think that's the key. I mean, if you hear Steve Van Roekel, the federal CIO, talk, which I'm sure you do quite often, he talks about kind of taking money out of IT and putting it into mission. I think that's a good example of maybe somewhere where you guys were able to find some efficiencies. So that's one of your things that you're most proud of. Give me some others that you, when you look back on your career as the CIO, that you really thought that you were able to accomplish a lot around.
Our messaging system, SMART, which is our overall official messaging, official and informal messaging system that absolutely every single user within the State Department that uses email is a customer of. That was a huge effort, and I think we did that successfully. And again, I think a lot of that success goes to partnering with the kind of business owner and the stakeholder, that they became owners of that project as much as the IT people that were executing it. And then I think the incorporation and institutionalization of social media tools. We're using more of them, not just on the fringes for new activities, but for doing some of the older things differently, communities of practice, getting people together to talk around certain issues in a way that they did not or could not do before and through social media. So I would say that would be number three.
Let's do this backwards and start with number three, because I think social media, the State Department's got a lot of attention for the use of social media. You know, during the Arab Spring, the State Department was out in front saying, you know, we are looking at Twitter, we are looking at Facebook to understand what's going on. That puts a lot of pressure on you as the CIO, because you have to come up with a policy, and there's privacy issues and there's security issues. How did you handle those issues? Because you're getting kind of pulled and pushed from two different directions.
Well, that's a lot broader than just a CIO issue. It's a public affairs issue. It's, as you say, a privacy issue, a records issue. I think we've always, as an agency, been open to the notion that social media is something that we need to be involved in. We were never one of the agencies that blocked participation on any of those kind of sites. So we've always had a healthy dialogue about the proper uses of or use of social media. And everybody's been engaged from every component of the department that would have a stake in that discussion. So we've never shied away from that. And I think that's been a huge advantage. We were always thought we had to be there and be engaged.
But didn't some of the use of social media come back to you? Because a lot of times CIOs get labeled the CIO no, and they're worried about, well, we can't have streaming video because of the security concerns, or we can't get onto Facebook because of bandwidth concerns. Did that come back to you or not really, because it was so central to what State's mission was?
I think largely it was so central to State's mission. And we do have periodic issues with certain kinds of streaming video, but to the point where when we see that, if it's degrading the network, we can identify top talkers and then go out and see if it's something they really should be engaged in, work-related and not watching the Final Four or something like that. You know, but in general, there has been an understanding, even among the IT world at the department, that it is something, those capabilities are something we need to do the State Department's mission.
Did you guys end up doing a social media policy or some kind of guidance?
Yes, we have a social media policy that's in the process of being revised, but we do have a social media policy that was done with the Public Affairs Bureau, a couple of other that are in our family, and the privacy and the CIO organization.
And then from a security standpoint, I guess that's the other side of the coin. How did you deal with the security for social media sites? Because I still think that's something that a lot of CIOs are struggling with.
Well, do you mean security and what people should and shouldn't
security
put out there, or
how to protect your network?
Protecting the network.
Yeah, how to protect your network from viruses and threats and open ports, because Twitter or Facebook or YouTube or whatever opens up
right.
Certain vulnerabilities.
So yes, but we've had, again, with diplomatic security, that diplomatic security and the IT organization IRM is a partnership in let's say protecting the network and its information from that standpoint. And we have made risk-based decisions on whether or not to do or allow certain things to happen. But in general, we haven't blocked them.
Can you talk a little bit about if you've had problems? I mean, I know that sometimes they get sensitive when you talk cyber, but have you had any threats, attacks, anything that you can talk about?
The things that you would hear about, we are subject to those same kind of attacks, but I would say not related to social media in any different way than any other agency would talk about, or any other major entity.
Because you guys also have been out in front, for instance, with iPads and iPhones and some of the tablet computers and smartphones. And I see that as part of that social media, leaning forward on social media. How do those two things relate? And does is it the same type of, you look at your mission and you say, okay, well, smartphones and iPads and tablet computers and other things can really make a difference in the way we interact and work with our customers?
Yes, I think we realize that we're a mobile, we're always saying we're a mobile organization. We're overseas in all these countries. We can't do our job effectively when you're talking core diplomacy functions or public affairs type functions, public diplomacy, sitting at your desk. So you need to be out. And all of those, the smartphones, the tablets, all facilitate that capability to be away from your desk and doing your job. We did have security issues. I mean, if you're talking the IT or the IA or our diplomatic security, the component that does technical security, there are concerns there, but we've had to weigh those concerns against what's the benefit to the mission. And I think we have become, I mean, still cautious, but forward-leaning. We allow the use of those devices. We allow them to connect to our network, but in a certain way. And we're now taking some of the next steps of looking at how we can allow more kind of data at rest on those devices, realizing that you're not always going to be able to be connected to a network, you know, connected to the internet, and you need to have some of that data residing on those devices and how we can do that securely.
Are you to the point yet with the bring your own device, or is it still State Department provided devices, or again?
It's a combination of both. If you can show that your job necessitates having one of those devices, there is no prohibition for the department to purchase one of those devices for you. Mm-hmm. But we also have a policy that you can use your own device and you can connect to the network as long as you connect to the network in a certain way. So we prescribe the way that that connection takes place. And if you follow that from any device, and any device can do that, then you can use your own device. So it's a combination of both.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about that messaging system a little bit. You're listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My special guest today is Susan Swart, the outgoing Chief Information Officer at the State Department.
This audio puzzle is brought to you by CenturyLink Government.
Let's see. Growing digital needs go here. So many different applications over here. So where does IT budget stretch to the limit go?
Fortunately, CenturyLink Government has an answer with its vast portfolio of cloud services, so customers get the right mix of performance and features. CenturyLink, solutions that work, service you can count on.
For a free risk assessment, visit CenturyLink.com/federal. This audio puzzle is brought to you by CenturyLink Government.
Okay, synchronized email and instant messaging over here. Merge web and video conferencing down here. But that leaves mobile, landline, and VoIP phones out of the loop.
Solve your agency's communications challenges with CenturyLink Government Unified Communications, products that work together and help deploying and maintaining them. CenturyLink, solutions that work, service you can count on.
For a free risk assessment, visit CenturyLink.com/federal.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jason Miller. My special guest today is Susan Swart, the State Department's Chief Information Officer. Now, Susan, before break, we're talking about a lot of your achievements and the stuff you're most proud of. One of the things you mentioned was the messaging system, commonly known as SMART. You said anyone who does email in the agency, which is probably everybody, is now using this system. What's the impact been of SMART? Why has it been something that's benefited the agency?
It's benefited the agency because it has provided more capabilities for the way we report officially through the telegram. You can add graphics, you can add links, you can add, you know, you can vary the type of text that you use. It's just, it's broadened the capabilities for doing that official reporting. Pictures, text, graphs, I think I said all that.
Do you still do telegrams, by the way? Is it dot, 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 stop?
No, not like that, but we do, you know, it's an exchange-based system. But we still use the telegram, yes.
Don't you think the email can't replace the telegram?
It might be able to replace the telegram in the sense of actually communicating the data, but there are a lot of other things that a telegram does that are still important to the State Department. And it creates an archive. It creates the historical record. We're one of the most queried people, you know, from a FOIA perspective. And it creates that record and that archive of State Department business in a way that I'm not sure email could do completely. But I'm just going to take that question a little bit further. I do think that the next go-around should be to look at, is a telegram still the best way for the department to officially communicate, create and share and store and archive and then re-access its reporting information, I think that's a big question for the future, a huge project for the future.
A huge, something that your next CIO wants.
Yes, the next one or the one after that.
Or the one after that, yes. Now, the thing about Smart was, because it's a global system, was the rollout difficult? Was it a matter of just getting people connected?
Technically, they were connected. The complexity of the rollout really centered around the people because it impacted everybody. You needed to make sure that everybody felt comfortable with the basic functions. And we had initially thought about just doing a very light touch on the human side and relying on online training. But in the end, we decided in consultation with the Foreign Service Institute, you know, about training, that that probably was not a good approach and did not go with that. And I think the rollout would not have been as successful if we had relied on kind of online training, because it was just too massive, too many, you know, we're talking not just English speakers, but people from other countries, their English isn't their first language. We needed that hands-on rollout experience.
You talked about some of the stuff you're most proud of, but what about stuff you wish maybe you could have spent more time working on or accomplished more around?
One would be data. You know, how do we organize our data? How do we standardize our data? How do we make it easy to query our data to make better management decisions or have a better understanding of certain events or places? We have a lot of data, a lot of reporting, a lot of information, but I think we can do a better job on how we organize that, how we do analysis around that.
And in fact, you know, I hear, again, going back to what I hear from other CIOs, the big data issue is the biggest challenge that's coming. When you look at it, is it just you weren't able to address some pieces of it just because you had other priorities that kind of moved ahead of it? Or had technologies just really catching up now between the cloud and some of the analytic tools?
I would think more of the first, not that there was, I mean, because there's always been technology around data for a long time, and it's really the notion that data is of common value, not just to the value of the people that own it. And we have made progress. We have some efforts underway to work on standardizing the data, defining data ownership, things like that, that we need to do to move in that direction. We have a data warehouse with a couple of data sets in it, but it's not as mature as it needs to be.
How do you get to the maturity? Is it a matter of just kind of keep going on the path of data standardization and understanding what data you have and how it works?
We have a good understanding of the data that we have. I think it's the standardization. And then from a technical perspective, how are we going to organize that data and where? Are we going to put it in a data warehouse? Are we going to create a data repository? You know, how then are we going to manage that data?
Are there other areas that you maybe would point to that said, I wish I would have spent more time around?
Finishing some of the consolidation things. And we put some of that into our portfolio stat, because that's the focus of the portfolio stat, utility IT, to finish some of those so we can stop discussing, to the extent that we still do, you know, this the kind of who should own what utility IT function and move on to, okay, what are the real things, the value add to the business of IT, which is really not around those things.
Have you guys put this through a portfolio stat yet, or
have you had one of the sessions?
Yes, we had
a portfolio stat.
Can you tell me just a little bit about how that worked?
How that was? I thought it was very good. You know, it was a lot of the upfront is very organized, the way they capture the data, because they're, you know, dealing with so many agencies. But the actual discussion, I think, was very much targeted towards the State Department. I didn't feel like they were trying to cram us into some rubric that would fit every agency. I think that they listened, and I think that they were happy with the things that we were proposing. I mean, there's work that we need to do, but I thought it was good. I thought it was good to have that discussion.
Because a lot of times with portfolio stat, you're bringing in people who maybe aren't used to talking about whatever the topic is. You got the program manager, but you also have the technology, the finance, the acquisition, very similar,
right,
I think, to the tech stat sessions,
right,
but even more broad.
Right.
Is that how yours kind of went down that,
yes,
path?
Well, we didn't have a particular program manager, because the things that we focused on, there are instances of those across multiple programs, multiple bureaus. But we had the key players, acquisitions, finance, IT, and senior management.
And I know this is just starting too, so you're probably going for the first round is always probably the most difficult one, because then you kind of learn from what you're doing, and then the next ones become easier, which kind of is a great segue to who gets to do it next, who the interim CIO until they hire a new one, and then what's your to-do list for that next person?
Steve Taylor, who is currently a deputy CIO for operations, he is going to be the acting CIO. He's had some jobs outside of IT, which I think that's a good thing for a CIO, because you see the perspective of the customer. As far as his to-do list, as I was cleaning out all my drawers, you know, and even some paper left by my predecessors. There are a lot of things that, nobody's going to be wanting for things to do. But I would say the focusing, you know, closing out some of these consolidations. We have a joint project that we're working on with AID to hopefully consolidate our IT platforms overseas to complete that. To take advantage, look at cloud as an option for some of our, what I'll say, more core activities. Right now we have a lot of things in the cloud, but they're outward facing. But to keep an eye on that from not just a security perspective, but, you know, service cost, contracting, all of those issues that either make it a good business decision or not. We're doing some regionalization, too, of some of our backroom functions overseas. So to look at that and then look at the some of the HR issues that we have, particularly in the Foreign Service, because we're hiring for a career. What are the kind of people that we should hire for that job when we look into the future compared to, you know, what we've hired over the last 20 years.
And obviously, these are the tech people you're talking about here, not the Foreign Service officers.
The IT professionals that are in the Foreign Service.
And as far as cloud goes, you said you have a lot of activities that are more outward-facing in the cloud. Mm-hmm. Like, give me an example or
we
a couple.
Have there's a content management system is in the cloud. That's the websites that Post put up overseas. We have our library, some information about our library, some historic records. We have foreignassistance.gov, humanrights.gov. But information that would be presented to the public, we've moved that from supporting it ourselves or have created some of those in the cloud. But we don't have, you know, we haven't moved mail. We haven't moved any what I would call mainstream internal applications or data to the cloud.
And obviously part of that RFP that we talked about very early in the conversation, mm-hmm. that is asking for some cloud services as well. I think maybe platform or infrastructure as a service.
Right, or how they would be provided, yes.
Right, because it's still obviously early on. We talked a lot about your time at State. We talked a little bit about your career as a Foreign Service. But you also played a key role in the CIO Council. And a lot of, I think people don't realize how much time CIOs such as yourself, you kind of split sometimes between those two roles. And CIO Council is very important and does take up a fair amount of your time. Talk a little bit about your role there and what some of the changes you've seen, not just in the CIO Council itself, but through the working groups that you've participated on.
I participated on the Best Practices Committee. Casey Coleman and I were co-chairs at one point in time. And then on a group that looked at the OMB 300 process. Those are probably the two major initiatives that I participated on. I think the CIO Council very much represents who's the federal CIO. There, you see, you know, what they're focusing on in what those various committees are doing, which is understandable. I think it's time consuming, but I think it's important for a CIO to take an opportunity at some point during their tenure to serve on one of those committees, to understand how the world that OMB works in, the complexities of that world, how difficult it can be to get so many different agencies behind an initiative when they're dealing with so many different missions that those CIO organizations are supporting. So I think it gives you a better perspective of that federal level IT world.
All right. Well, we are unfortunately out of time, and you've been listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My special guest today was Susan Swart, the outgoing State Department Chief Information Officer. I'm Jason Miller, your host. Susan, thank you so much for sitting down with us one last time.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Ask the CIO on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The show has been sponsored by CenturyLink. If you missed any portion of this broadcast, you can hear the show in its entirety on demand or podcast on federalnewsradio.com.